I'll look at the screen here and see if I can get a couple of yeses. Okay, I got a couple of yeses. Okay, so I guess you can hear me. Okay, tonight, as you know, the topic is some of Rothbard's readings on the case against the Fed. And in that regard, I would highly recommend his book, A History of Money and Banking in the United States. And that's where the longer reading comes from anyway. And it's one of the great treatises written on money and banking by an economist. And there aren't too many. There are only three or four that have been written as treatises. And Rothbard is one of them. And so and what I thought I would do is, since Rothbard started out talking about the myth of the independent Fed, I would talk about that also, since I've written an article or two about it. And I would start by pointing out how the mainstream of the economics profession has taught generations of students about what the Fed is and what the Fed does. And one way to look at this is to look at what the best-selling textbook from 1948 into the 1980s said about the Fed. That would be Economics by Paul Samuelson. And here's what Samuelson said in his 1989 edition. I'm quoting, "The Federal Reserve's goals are steady growth in national output and low unemployment. Its sworn enemy is inflation. If aggregate demand is excessive so that prices are being bid up, the Federal Reserve Board may want to slow the growth of the money supply, thereby slowing aggregate demand and output growth. If unemployment is high and business languishing, the Fed may consider increasing the money supply, thereby raising aggregate demand and augmenting output growth. In a nutshell, this is the function of central banking, which is an essential part of macroeconomic management in all mixed economies." So that's what generations of students were taught about the Fed by the MIT professor and Nobel Prize winner Paul Samuelson, that printing more money creates prosperity when there's a need to create more prosperity, and that the Fed is sort of one big Wizard of Oz that manages, in his words, manages the economy by avoiding too much inflation and too little unemployment. Another book that was the second biggest seller during this era is a book called Economics, also by Campbell McConnell. And he says something even funnier. He says this in his book, "Because it is a public body, the decisions of the Board of Governors of the Fed are made in what it perceives to be the public interest. The Federal Reserve banks are not guided by the profit motive, but rather they pursue those measures which the Board of Governors recommends. The fundamental objective of monetary policy is to assist the economy in achieving a full employment, non-inflationary level of total output." And so that's the general theme, that since it is government, it is by definition immune from self-interest, and it is also omniscient in that and effective in creating a system that avoids ups and downs of the business cycle. That's the job of the Fed. And I guess that goes a long way to explaining why so many people are skeptical of critics of the Fed. But of course, the Fed has always been a political tool, as Rothbard says, used to finance deficits and to get government to spend a lot more money than what the voters would approve through taxation. For example, when Franklin Roosevelt famously tried to pack the Supreme Court to overturn decisions that ruled his first New Deal unconstitutional, he did not succeed at first, but eventually did when several members of the court died or retired, and he was able to pack the court with political cronies. Well, he also packed the Fed with political cronies. He appointed as head of the Fed Mariner Eccles, who was a Democratic Party hack who did not even have a college degree and had no experience in finance, and yet he was put in charge as chairman of the Fed. And he eventually was succeeded by Henry Morgenthau, and so the Fed was essentially run by Roosevelt as his own political tool. And there's an economist named the late Robert Weintraub who wrote a lot about this about 20 years ago or so, about the political influence on the Fed. And there is a good literature in the field of economics on the politicization of the Fed. And let me give you an idea of one of the things that Robert Weintraub wrote about. He found that the Fed fundamentally changed its course, its policy course, in 1953, 1961, 1969, 1974, and 1977. These are all years in which the presidency changed hands. And his thesis is that Fed chairmen, like everyone else, want to keep their jobs, and so they will do whatever they perceive the president wanting them to do, regardless of whether or not the economy has changed and justifies, in theory, a different policy. They want to keep their job. And let me read to you some of the effects of this type of behavior. According to Robert Weintraub, President Eisenhower wanted slower money growth. The money supply grew by 1.73% during his administration, the lowest rate in a decade. President Kennedy desired somewhat faster money creation. From January 61 to November 63, the money supply grew by 2.31%. Lyndon Johnson required rapid money creation to finance his expansion of the welfare-warfare state. As a result, money supply growth more than doubled to 5%. And these varying rates of monetary growth all occurred under the same Fed chairman, William McChesney Martin. So every time a new president would come in, Martin would pay close attention to what that president wanted and do it. In fact, the whole nomination process of the Fed shows how the Senate and the president influence Fed behavior, because they send out signals regarding who is acceptable and who is not. Only the acceptable, pliable people can become chairman of the Fed. Continuing, Arthur Burns was the successor of William McChesney Martin, and he was such a strong supporter of Richard Nixon that the money supply was already growing very robustly at 10.5%. In the third quarter of 1972, right before the 72 election. But to help Nixon get reelected, Arthur Burns made the money supply grow even faster, so that the growth rate in the money supply in 1972 was the fastest for any one year since 1945. Then President Ford came along, and he called for slower monetary growth because price inflation had been stirred up. And he had his WIP Inflation Now program, WIN was the cheesy acronym. So the Fed went from more than 10.5% money growth to 4.7% growth. Then Jimmy Carter gets elected, and Arthur Burns again complied with what Jimmy Carter wanted by stepping up the monetary growth rate to 8.5% at that time. So there's a clear record of Fed chairman paying close attention to what their bosses want them to do. It is a political institution. There's an economist also named Edward Cain who has published some academic journal articles where he points out that the Fed's ultimate political function is to serve as a political scapegoat for when things go wrong, a scapegoat for members of Congress. He writes about how Congress influences Fed behavior. Here's what he says. Whenever monetary policies are popular, incumbents can claim that their influence was crucial in their adaptation. On the other hand, when monetary policies prove unpopular, they can blame everything on a stubborn Federal Reserve and claim further that things would have been worse had they not pressed Fed officials at every opportunity. In return for this favor, the Fed is allowed to amass a huge slush fund by earning interest income from the government securities it purchases through open market operations. And that, by the way, is how the Fed operates its finances its own operations and pays the salaries of the people that work there. When it buys bonds, government bonds, it owns those bonds, and the interest income from those bonds is the income that is used to finance the salaries and perks of Fed employees. And so there is a built-in incentive there, that bureaucratic incentive for inflation, because the people who run the Fed literally profit by creating inflation. Okay, And so that's the game that is being played. And of course, the Fed uses regulation as a political tool as well. The Fed, I would recommend one of my articles from lewrockwell.com. It's entitled "The Myth of the Libertarian Fed," and it mentions how, in addition to monetary policy, the Fed has dozens and dozens of regulatory activities that it engages in. It regulates every aspect of financial markets in America, along with other regulatory agencies as well, like the Securities and Exchange Commission, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and so forth. But the Fed often uses regulation as a political tool. A good example is its enforcement of the Community Reinvestment Act, which essentially the Fed strong-arms banks into making bad loans to so-called subprime borrowers. And if they don't, they can be in trouble. They can have their expansion plans vetoed by the Fed. They can have their charters rejected. Mergers can be turned down and so forth if they don't do what the Fed wants. And so the Fed has always been used as a political tool. And that's what Rothbard is talking about in the first part of this article, where he just sort of mocks and ridicules the idea that the Fed is independent, or that it should be independent. It's a government institution. In Ben Bernanke's textbook, I quoted him in a speech as saying, in one sentence, the Fed is not influenced by politics, and then in the very next sentence he says, the chairman of the Fed is appointed by the president. And so, you know, how could that be? How could a presidential appointee not be influenced by politics? It makes no sense at all. And so that's really point number one that I would want to make. And by the way, if you want to read my commentary on this, it's from an article of mine that I was originally published in the Freeman, entitled "The Myth of the Independent Fed," and it was also reprinted by the Independent Institute. It's online. Independent.org has a copy of the article online. It seems to be the first thing to pop up if you search for it online. And that version of it includes all the footnotes to the research by Kane and Weintraub and the others, if anyone is interested in looking it up. Okay, so then getting into the history of money, Rothbard does a real nice job here of going step by step into the history of money. Most college students that I know of, that I teach, are unaware of the fact that government did not create money. Money evolved in the free market originally, and then government took it over and nationalized it. But money evolved in the free market. And, of course, one of the reasons it came into being was the problems of barter. When people are trading goods for goods, they run into the problem if you want bread and you have shoes, you have to find somebody who has bread and who also wants shoes, and so or you have to do a lot of trading, sort of intermediate trading, to get a bundle of things that you might be able to trade for the things that you actually want. But if you can have one medium of exchange that everyone agrees on, that you can use to buy bread and shoes and everything else, well, that makes life much simpler, and it makes the economy much more productive. You don't have to spend any time shopping around to figure out how to get shoes out of bread by buying car tires first and then finding somebody who has shoes or bread or whatever. And so you can spend your time working and being productive rather than engaging in all this running around just for very simple transactions. And so money is first function is a medium of exchange, and it makes everyone in the economy remarkably more productive. It also solves the problem of economic calculation that we've talked about before in the class. And the problem of economic calculation, of course, is the key problem of why socialism could never work, and that an entrepreneur, in order to know that he is succeeding in adding value to the economy, has to calculate profits and losses. And how do you do that? Well, you need money as a medium of exchange in order to figure out whether or not you're taking $1 million worth of resources and turning it into more or less than $1 million worth of products that people are willing to pay for. And so economic calculation is impossible without money. And among the commodities that human beings have chosen as money over the centuries, I wrote down a little list here, and this is just a short list. They've used many other things. iron, salt, sugar, beaver skins, codfish, tobacco, cigarettes, copper, and gold and silver, of course. And of course, eventually, the whole world adopted gold and silver as the most reliable forms of money. And for a number of reasons, they have inherent value. Gold and silver are worth something in and of themselves, in addition to being a medium of exchange. And it's a virtue also that they are in limited supply. It takes a lot of effort and time to significantly increase the world supply of gold and silver. And that's a good thing, not a bad thing. They're portable, and they're divisible. You can divide them up into one-ounce coins, for example, or half-ounce coins. You can carry them around. You can transport them. They're homogeneous. An ounce of gold here in America is the same as an ounce of gold anywhere else. So it's a homogeneous product. And, of course, they're durable. They last a long, long time, much longer than codfish or sugar or beaver skins, which human beings once used as a medium of exchange. And so another important idea that Rothbard gets into is the whole idea of the optimal supply of money, which so-called mainstream economists worry about often. There are many articles that have been written in books over the years about the optimal supply of money, how much money should there be. Well, Rothbard's position and the position of most Austrians who are students of the gold standard understand that once a society has chosen a particular medium as their money, gold was the most frequently chosen whenever the free market was allowed to work, for example, it's because there's enough of it around to finance all the transactions that people are undergoing. And of course, there's the velocity of money. If I pay you something in gold, you go out and buy things, and you spend that money on some things, and then the people you spend the money on, they go out and buy some things, and they spend it on, so there's a multiplier effect through what's called the velocity of money. And generally, when people accept something like gold or silver, they've accepted it because it works, and it did work. And no further money supply is needed. As an economy grows, you don't need a constant increase in the supply of money, thanks to the velocity of money. And so there's no discussion with Rothbard of what the optimal supply of money is. The optimal supply of money is what is chosen in the free market. It can't be chosen by central planners with PhDs in economics. And, of course, another point that Rothbard makes is one that people like Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed, don't seem to get, is that falling prices can be virtuous if they're caused by increased production. After all, you know, look at the so-called high-tech industries, the computer industries, the software products, iPods, personal computers, laptops, and how the prices have just gone through the floor of computers. The first computer I bought in the early 80s cost $4,000, and it was a piece of junk compared to the $300 laptop that I just bought a couple of months ago, a tiny notebook laptop, and which is tens of thousands of times more powerful for a small fraction of the money. And there's nothing to be fearful of that. You know, of course, the current Fed chairman, what he's known for in his academic writings is making the case for a constant price inflation, it's fear of deflation. But there's no reason to fear deflation at all of prices if it's caused by increased production. Okay, if it's caused by the Fed, that's another matter. But if it's caused by just increased production of goods and services, it's all good. More stuff at lower prices is nothing we should be criticizing. And Rothbard begins his sort of entree into discussing the Fed and central banking by talking about the effects of counterfeiting. And this is really an important point in understanding who benefits from the Fed. And he says, which of course he considers to be legalized counterfeiting. And those who get the most benefit are the people who get the money the first, people who are the first ones to get their hands on the money. So if you're a counterfeiter, you're in your basement printing out $100 bills, and you get away with it, and you spend all that money, Well, you benefit by being able to benefit from all the things that you bought with all that money. But then eventually, as the multiplier process works itself out, the people you spend the money on, they in turn will spend it on some things. And the people that get their money will spend it on things. Prices will be bid up. And so by the time the money makes its way to you and me, or the ordinary people, we don't get nearly as much a benefit from any expansion in the money supply, if any benefit at all, because all we get is inflation, price inflation. And so those who get the money first benefit the most. If you fast forward to the world we live in with central banking, when the government expands the money supply, one way in which it does it is to start buying securities, buying government bonds, for example. And when it does that, it's putting money in the hands of bond sellers. And, of course, the big New York Wall Street investment banks conduct the transactions. So they are among the first to profit from the expansion of the money supply. They get the money before it has caused the price inflation. By the time it makes its way through the multiplier process, the average citizen doesn't see any benefit at all, really. Another thing it does, counterfeiting does, is it does change relative prices because the money does not come out all at once like it's thrown out of a helicopter, as Milton Friedman famously said in some of his writings. It'll affect different parts of the economy differently. If the lion's share of the money originates in New York City and Wall Street, well, then industries related to what's in New York City and Wall Street will be stimulated first at the expense of other parts of the economy. So relative prices will be changed. We won't have general price inflation like the so-called monetarists say because the money is not distributed equally. And also, we will have a boom and bust cycle. And so the boom and bust cycle is one of the things that the Austrians are known for that monetary expansion causes, whether it's caused through counterfeiting, legal or illegal. You know, legal counterfeiting, of course, is another word for central banking. And I guess the essence, I guess I could go over the essence of the Austrian business cycle theory, is that normally when people save money, the act of savings increases the pool of capital, financial capital, available for capital markets. Okay, so people withdraw from consumption and they save some money. The savings fuels productivity growth and the production of goods and services. These goods and services are put on the market, and since the people have been saving some of their money, they're in a position to buy some of these goods and services. Now, when the interest rate falls not through increased savings, but through the expansion of the money supply by the Fed, you do have a reduction in interest rates as you would with increased savings because the increased availability of credit pushes interest rates down also. But in this case, you don't have the savings to fall back on that the people have made. People have not saved more. The Fed has artificially reduced interest rates through monetary expansion. And so all the lower interest rates do cause a boom in investment spending in some industries, such as the housing boom that we've experienced in recent years. But at some point, it is realized that the people do not have enough money to purchase the products that are put out in the boom, and the bust occurs. And so that is really the story, in a nutshell, the boom and bust cycle that is caused by the Fed, and in which is the main cause of the current worldwide depression that we're still in. And so under a system where you have gold or gold-backed money, the way that it once worked was that if banks issued currency to make it easier to undergo transactions, they backed it in gold or silver, or they backed most of it in gold and silver. And those banks that were responsible and had high reserves of gold and silver were rewarded by the increasing value of their currency because people trusted it. Those banks who were irresponsible and inflated their currency, people caught on that the currency was inflated and it now took more of it to purchase the same bundle of goods and services that they normally purchase. And they will start to redeem their currency for gold or silver. If you run in the bank, and the bank may go bankrupt. So competition between banks disciplined the banks in a way that minimized price inflation and also minimized boom and bust And by the way, since there was a lot of competition and the money supply was not monopolized by the central government, if there was a bust or bankruptcy, it was always localized or regional. It wasn't nationwide or international. And so, you know, nothing on this earth is perfect. No banking system is perfect. But the gold standard did minimize price inflation and that sort of bad behavior. And so, but of course, governments have always wanted to monopolize the money as one of the commanding heights of the economy. And that's where central banking comes in. And really, the Bank of England is sort of the mother of all central banks. Most other countries copied the Bank of England one way or another in creating a government-run bank that monopolizes the money supply. And Rothbard offers two main reasons for central banking. One, to finance deficit spending. The Fed is every politician's dream. They can increase spending and buy votes with money without taxing anybody. Taxing people loses votes. Spending money on people wins votes. The Fed enables politicians to have all win and no lose in politics. They can spend money without having to confront anybody who might vote for them with a tax bill. Of course, the tax is real and it's hidden. It's hidden in the form of price inflation and boom and busts, but the average citizen does not understand that. And so they blame capitalism or greed, or they go and occupy Wall Street, things like that. Second reason for central banking is it cartelizes the banking industry. Now, in the story I just told about the gold standard, any one bank that wanted to inflate its currency and lend out significantly more money in currency than it had in reserves ran the risk of bankruptcy. The creation of the Fed or any central bank eliminates that. The Fed is the lender of last resort. It will bail out anybody who runs into trouble. That's why it was created. And so it increases the limits on money creation. Sometimes almost abolishes the limits on money creation by banks. So banks can lend a lot more money. Of course, the Fed operates this game through so-called reserve requirements by telling banks how much they have to have in reserve compared to how much they lend out. So if the Fed says there's a 5% reserve requirement, you can lend out 20 times the amount that you actually have in reserves. And so that's the game. And of course, there's a long discussion here of the history of central banking. And there's a great quote on page 44 of the article that I put in the syllabus that I think is worth repeating because it really explains the origins of central banking, at least part of it. And here's what Rothbard says. He says, the Wall Street banks found the money supply sufficiently elastic when they generated inflationary booms by means of credit expansion. The Central Reserve city banks could pyramid notes and deposits on top of gold and thereby generate multiple inverse pyramids of monetary expansion on top of their own expansion of credit. That was fine. The problem came then when late in the inflationary booms, the banking system ran into trouble and people started calling on the banks to redeem their notes and deposits in specie. At that point, since all of the banks were inherently insolvent, they, led by the Wall Street banks, were forced to contract their loans rapidly in order to stay in business, thereby causing a financial crisis and a system-wide contraction of the supply of money and credit. The banks were not interested in the contention that this sudden bust was a payback for a wiping out of the excesses of the inflationary boom that they had generated. They wanted to be able to keep expanding credit during recession as well as booms. Hence, their call for a remedy to monetary inelasticity, as they call it, during recessions. And that remedy, of course, was the grand old nostrum that nationalists and bankers had been pushing for since the beginning of the Republic, a central bank. So that's exactly why there's always been a movement to create a central bank. And, of course, the story, it's a long story of how we got the Fed, but I can outline it in general. In that Rothbard mentions at the very beginning of the Republic there was a push for a central bank, and there was because the mercantilists like Alexander Hamilton understood that the mercantilist empire of Great Britain was funded and financed by the Bank of England. So they wanted to bring a government-run bank to America, or create one, similar to the Bank of England. And so the first example of this was the Bank of North America, which was the brainchild of Robert Norris, Robert Morris, rather, who was the chief financier of the Federalist Party and Alexander Hamilton's puppet master in politics. That bank only lasted about a year, a little over a year, because people did not trust its currency, and so it was privatized. That was really the first national bank. And so the same forces of politics who wanted a national bank went to work and started agitating for what eventually would become the Bank of the United States. And Alexander Hamilton was the foremost champion of this. And he had a long, drawn-out debate with Thomas Jefferson and others over this. And eventually, we did get the first Bank of the United States. George Washington signed it into law. And it created 72% price inflation in its first 5 years. It corrupted politics by helping to fund political careers of people friendly to the Federalist Party. And it had a 20-year charter, and Congress did not renew its charter after 20 years. It was started in 1794 because of this, because it created boom and busts, and it created price inflation, and it corrupted politics, just as its opponents predicted. Then the War of 1812 came along, and the government resurrected the Bank of the United States and created the Second Bank of the United States to monetize the debt, so-called, to monetize the deficit that had been created to finance the War of 1812. And so that was the reason in which it was brought back, and it went back into operation in the year 1817 in January, and it promptly created the Panic of 1819, which is the topic of Murray Rothbard's doctoral dissertation at Columbia. Okay, and so it created a boom and bust. It also corrupted politics. Famous politicians like Daniel Webster and Henry Clay were literally on the payroll of the Bank of the United States. And that led to the great confrontation between Andrew Jackson, President Andrew Jackson, and Nicholas Biddle, the head of the Bank of the United States. And Jackson vetoed the rechartering of the Bank of the United States in the 1830s and defunded it. And Rothbard considers that to be a great victory for libertarianism in general and for freedom, the ending of the Bank of the United States. Andrew Jackson also paid off totally the national debt of the United States during his term. And monetizing the debt, by the way, is simply printing money to pay the government's bills. And that's what the Fed does. And so so you had the destruction of the central bank by the early 1840s. And the monetary system that existed after that was called the independent treasury system. We were still on the gold standard. Most banks backed money, currency by gold. There were competing currencies, there were state-chartered banks, but the forces of nationalism were still led by the Whig Party and then eventually the Republican Party, and Abraham Lincoln was the most vociferous proponent of bringing back some sort of nationalized banking system, which he did during his administration with the Legal Tender Acts and the National Currency Acts. There were several of them. It created the greenbacks as the monopoly money supply of the country. It taxed the state-chartered banks and established a monetary monopoly in the federal government. It did not create a central bank, but it did go a long way to the creation of a central bank. It was an important stepping stone in the eventual creation of the Fed in 1913. And, of course, Rothbard discusses this very interesting story of how the Fed was created. And I'm not going to repeat the whole story because he very eloquently and very in great detail gives chapter and verse of and names of who was involved, how it came into being, and especially the important role of intellectuals in propagandizing for a central bank. And so And so, of course, I recommend that anybody that you read that. I'm not going to just repeat the whole story. And the system, by the way, the system that was created, the National Currency Act system, there are economists that have studied that system. And it wasn't the worst system in the history of the world, but there were several stock market panics, several depressions during that time, and a lot of economic instability. The saving grace was those periods for which the money supply was tied to gold, and that created a relative monetary stability for long periods of time. But we did eventually get the Fed, of course, by 1913. The depression of 1907 was used as an excuse for why we need a Fed. And typically, this is how government operates. There were laws periodically that would suspend specie payment, which means that the Congress would tell the banks, you don't need to back your currency with gold anymore. And so they would inflate the money supply, it would create a boom and bust cycle. And then when the bust would come, the government would respond by saying, we, the government, need more power to control the economy, even though they caused the problem in the first place. That's typical of how government always operates. And that's what happened with the creation of the Fed. And so the Fed was created in 1913. And promptly financed in large part, probably a fourth to a third of the American participation in World War I. And a good case can be made that were it not for the creation of the Fed, America may have never entered World War I. And my old friend Jim Powell, who wrote a book called Wilson's War, makes a very compelling case. And had America not entered World War I, there may not have been a World War II. He argues that the European powers would have settled things on their own. Woodrow Wilson would not have become dictator of the world for a short period of time and influenced world events in the way that he did. And it's an intriguing hypothesis. But certainly, I think the most convincing part of this story is that without the Fed, the U.S. may not have been able to participate in World War I, although we did have the income tax come online in the same year, and they could have used that, but of course you're limited because that's a direct tax, and you lose votes as a politician by directly taxing people for unpopular government programs. But you can have the Fed print money to finance unpopular government programs for a long, long time. And of course, an important part of this whole story is when Rothbard talks about the role of the progressive intellectuals here. And in the context of what the so-called progressive intellectuals did with banking is to was all part of the myths that they had created about the free market in general, whether it's the banking industry, the railroad industry, the trucking industry, the food industry, the so-called natural monopolies. There was a whole series of myths that were created that the free market, if left to its own devices, would generate monopolies everywhere. And then there's the Marxist idea that there would eventually be just one big monopoly controlling everything. And of course, that only came true under socialism, where the government was one big monopoly in the former Soviet Union and all the other socialist countries. But this argument was made for trucking, food, and so forth. But the whole history of the regulation of that era is that industry itself often wanted regulation, which it thought it could control and use to enforce cartels or monopolies. When the Interstate Commerce Commission was created in 1887, supposedly it was created to protect consumers from monopolistic railroad barons. Well, the first president of the Interstate Commerce Commission was a railroad industry president. And what the commission did was to establish monopoly prices in the railroad business. So it was captured by the railroad industry. The big food processors were in favor of the Pure Food and Drug Act that created the Food and Drug Administration because they understood that it would be disproportionately harmful to their smaller competitors and would monopolize their economic power for them. When the Civil Aeronautics Board was created in the 1920s, it was used to monopolize the airline industry by regulating prices and kept prices at monopoly prices for decades. It was illegal to compete with price during the era of the Civil Aeronautics Board from the 1920s to the 1970s. The Fed is the exact same thing. The Fed was an attempt by bankers to create a government institution that would allow them to have a government-run cartel. Cartels are always unstable. They never last long because of cheating. One member of the cartel cheats by lowering his prices or cheating on the market sharing deal that they made regarding production, the quantity of production. Once one person cheats, everybody else falls in the line and cheats as well before there's no money to be made anymore by cheating. The only way to get around that is to have the cartel agreement enforced by government itself. That's what happened with trucking, with airlines, with food regulation, and with money, with the Fed. And so the Fed was always an attempt by the so-called progressives to cartelize the banking industry. And so all the talk about the progressives being anti-business or they're wanting to rein in big business with government regulation is baloney. They were in bed with big business. And you really see it in spades during the World War One. And especially during the New Deal, where the whole New Deal was an attempt to cartelize agriculture and manufacturing with government-sponsored cartels that set prices for agriculture and manufacturing. And so that's an important part of the story of how we got to the Fed. And I'm not going to repeat the long, long story that Rothbard does such a great job of repeating of all the individuals involved and so forth, but that's the story that he tells. And so from then on, you know, in terms of what I started talking about, the Fed as a political animal, it has also contributed to what economists call the political business cycle. If you Google political business cycles, you'll find lots of literature on this, where, and there's been research done on this for decades, of government's attempt. It doesn't say that government is so good at central planning that it can manipulate elections with some kind of precision. But what it does do is there's usually an explosion of spending in the 6-month to a 12-month period before national elections. For obvious reasons, politicians want to get themselves reelected by handing out goodies or apparent freebies to their voting constituencies. And they do their best to defer and hide the cost to their voters. And of course, the Fed is the ideal mechanism for hiding the cost of government. And so, regardless of the condition that the economy is in, there tends to be an explosion in government spending before every election. And that creates what's called a political business cycle, as opposed to just the economic business cycle. And the Fed, since its creation, has always been a major instigator of political business cycles, because it helps the government finance these things without having to raise taxes. And the Fed has also been an important instrument of war, because war is always very costly, of course, and if you finance war with taxation, you'll have fewer wars, and the wars that do exist will be shorter, because the people will be demand that it is, in fact, a necessary war if it's going to cost them many thousands of dollars in additional taxes. But if you can hide the cost of war with money, legalized counterfeiting, that doesn't happen. The people are unaware that it's really costing them more. For war, they'll blame the capitalists. They'll blame businesses for raising their prices. They won't blame the Fed at all. And so the Fed has been a major instigator of war and the warfare state. And of course, it's also been a major funder of the welfare state. That's why politicians like Ron Paul zero in so much on the Fed. It's even if the Fed only finances, say, 20% or 30% of the welfare and warfare state, it's invisible financing. People don't feel the pinch. They don't relate that it is costing them something, like they relate to an actual tax bill that is costing them something. So it's the politician's dream. And that, by the way, is why state governments have a lot more luck in balancing their budgets. They don't have a Fed. They don't have something, a fairy godmother to print money to finance their activities. They have to finance most of what they do by taxes. And of course, they have to confront their own taxpayers with the exception of money that comes from the federal government to them, the so-called revenue sharing that comes to them, which in itself is sort of a cartel scheme whereby we tax all the government, all the state government, all people of the state governments, put the money into one big pool, and then divvy it out to the governors. Whereas if any one governor were to try to increase taxes significantly, he would run into the cartel problem, and that the other surrounding governors in the surrounding states, if they did not do the same thing, then there would be an exodus away from the high tax state of two lower tax states of individuals and businesses. And so the government sort of runs a cartel of governments with so-called revenue sharing or intergovernmental grants, if you will. Okay, and so that's about what I wanted to say in my overview of the Fed, and it's about a 45-minute overview. That's about what I've been doing with these classes, and so I think I see there are a bunch of questions here, so I'm going to go right into the Q&A part by looking at some of your questions. Let's see, David Kramer wants to know the difference between the multiplier effect and the velocity effect. Well, velocity is simply the number of times money turns over, into different hands. The multiplier effect has to do with the effect on GDP. It's a calculation of the effect of an increase in government spending, for example, of $1 billion. How does that have an effect on gross domestic product after all this changing of hands has taken place? Whereas velocity is just a measure of how many times money changes hands in a given time period. So it's a different concept. Let's see. Chris Branko wants to know, I suggested a book in my last class about Jackson's fight against the bank and Biddle. Yeah, the title of the book is Andrew Jackson's Bank War, I believe. Robert Remini is the title. It's spelled R-E-M-I-N-I. Yeah, I think it's Andrew Jackson in the Bank Wars, something like that. But look up Robert Remini on Amazon.com, and you'll find the book on the bank wars. Let's see what else. Let's see if we have some questions here. Let's see. John wants to know, how do I explain Volcker's policy of high interest rates? Well, actually, Paul Volcker came in and reduced the growth of the money supply dramatically, which is exactly what Ronald Reagan wanted him to do, and interest rates went down. Mortgage rates at one point were in the 20% range in the late 70s, and they went down, by the mid-80s, they were down into the 8 or 9% range. And so interest rates went down as a result of what Volcker did. He essentially eliminated price inflation with a tight money policy. And he eliminated what's called the inflation premium. When banks anticipate, say, 10% inflation next year, they have to charge 10% more in interest on their loans because they don't want to be paid back in inflated money, in money that is worth 10% less in purchasing power. And so that's what Volcker did, actually. So let's see if we have other questions. Let's see, Matthew asked me, did I hear correctly that higher rates of money printing lead to greater profits for Fed board members? I didn't use the word profits, I don't believe, but the way the Fed finances its own operations, including salaries and fringe benefits of all Fed employees, is the interest on government bonds that the Fed owns. So when the Fed has an expansionary monetary policy, one of the ways it expands the money supply is that it buys bonds. It's called quantitative easing today. They purchase bonds, and so they're putting money in the hands of people who are giving them bonds in return. Then they're paid interest on those bonds, and they're allowed to keep a large portion of the interest income. Congress supposedly decides what percentage, but they usually give the Fed a great deal of leeway to just keep as much of that as they want. And so, and by the way, with the Fed's historically crazy expansionary monetary policies, it is as wealthy as it has ever been as an institution. And let me read you something from my book, The Myth of the Independent Fed, quite a long time ago, in the mid-90s, there was an article about there was a partial audit of the Fed. And we did learn a little bit about the income of the Fed as an institution. And here's some of the things that were reported in a Wall Street Journal article about this. Let me see if I can even give you the reference. Is the actual article is Susan Alexander Ryan and John Wilkie banking on publicity. Oh no, that's wrong. I'm sorry, that's the wrong one. Forget about that. See, where is it? Oh no, here it is. It's John Wilkie, same author, W-I-L-K-E. Fed's huge empire set up years ago is costly and inefficient. It was in the Wall Street Journal on September 12, 1996, page one. And it's, you can get it in the Wall Street Journal archives. And here's what it said. At 1995, the Fed spent over $2 billion on itself in 1996. Fed officials, Fed has over 25,000 employees at that time. It had its own air force of 47 Lear jets for Fed bureaucrats and small cargo planes. It has fleets of vehicles, including personal cars for 59 Fed bank managers. A full-time curator oversees the Fed's collection of paintings and sculptures. The Fed held $451 billion with a B in accumulated assets as of 1996, when it was engaged in building for itself several new executive office buildings. The number of Fed employees earning more than $125,000 a year more than doubled from 1993 to 1996. And even the head janitor in the Fed building in Washington, who has a job title of Support Services Director, was paid $163,800 in salary plus fringe benefits. Money is also spent lavishly on professional memberships, entertainment, and travel. And so the money, being a Fed bureaucrat is a very profitable gig for economists and other people who work for the Fed. And they don't do much work for them, by the way, after all. I've known economists like me, academic economists, who have worked for various Fed banks, Federal Reserve of St. Louis or something, and they've told me over the years that the only thing they're really required to do is write two or three short articles for the Fed magazine that comes out by all the different Fed banks. And that's the kind of thing I could do in about a week, and you get 52 weeks salary for that. So it's a pretty good gig. Let's see. And will the average person benefit from a 100% reserve system? Well, that's the same question as saying, will the average person benefit from putting an end to the constant boom and bust cycles that the Fed has created? It created a boom in the NASDAQ market first, created a boom in the stock market, which also busted, created a boom in the housing market next, which has busted. The average person would benefit from getting rid of that. The average person would also benefit from the diminishing, if not elimination, of price inflation or deflation, the lower prices. You know, what a terrible thing it would be if you had to pay less money for your next new car, which is what Ben Bernanke thinks would be terrible if we had something like that, but not according to the Austrians. Would fractional banking occur without the Fed? Well, yeah, sure it could, but the system under the gold standard, there were fractional reserve banks, but it's all relative. If you held, say, three-fourths of your outstanding loans in reserve, that's a high proportion, and you would be a much more stable bank than if you only held, say, 5% in reserve. And so, sure, there have been periods where there wasn't 100% gold reserves that worked reasonably well, and the people would flock, the customers would flock to the more stable banks because their currency would not be inflated. It would be worth more. You could buy more with it. It would be more stable. And so the banks that behave more responsibly and approached 100% reserves would be the most profitable banks in a system like that. Let's see, who else has a question here? And no, I can't explain the consequences of multiple inverted pyramids, so I'm sorry about that. Yeah, you could ask a question for the about a previous lecture. Todd has a question. That's fine. Yeah, Eric has a good question. The focus on credit and money supply is a remnant of Keynesianism. One of the things that that distinguishes the Austrians, like Rothbard, from Keynesian economics, is that we understand that you need savings and investment and production to have prosperity. The Keynesians think spending, but you have to save and invest and produce first and create things before you can make money to spend. The Keynesians think you can spend money that comes out of thin air, and prosperity is created simply by spending. And so that's why you see in the media, especially, the focus on spending and borrowing and putting money, taking out more credit card debt and so forth. It's convoluted economics. It's bad economics. It ignores the fact that you first have to save and invest and produce in order to have money. Modern example of small fractional, I guess he means fractional reserve banking working over the long term. It depends on what a long term is. The Fed allows very small fractions, 5%, 2% reserves, but it has always called itself the lender of last resort. So if a bank gets in trouble by inflating its currency, the Fed bails it out. And so, yeah, you can last a very long time, but we're sort of at the final bubble position now where the gig is up. And so, yeah, it can last for decades. Government-run cartels often do last for decades. The Interstate Commerce Commission cartelized the railroad industry, and then when trucks came into being, they cartelized the trucking industry. And it was not disbanded until the late 1970s. So it was about 90 years that cartel lasted. And so the Fed cartel, it's 100 years old in two more years. It's almost the same age as the old Interstate Commerce Commission cartel was. So, yeah, the fractional reserve banks can last a long time under that regime, but not under a gold standard where they're punished for their irresponsible lending practices. No, I can't think of any that I know of without government backing. Let's see. Rothbard doesn't consider a consumption tax to be better than an income tax because a tax on sales does reduce your income. And if your income goes down, you have less money to save or to consume. So a so-called consumption tax is a tax on savings. That's the main thing that economists who are in favor of a national sales tax, that's the main point they make, that they think that if you tax consumption in that way, it'll tilt the balance toward more saving and less consumption. Not necessarily, because you're taxing income. So a so-called consumption tax really is an income tax. That's why Rothbard doesn't think it's anything especially beneficial to switch the type of taxation, and says the focus really should be on government spending. That's a better measure of taxation because it's a measure of how many resources the government directly takes out of the economic system through all its various taxing schemes. And the fair tax is not very fair anyway. If it imposes a big sales tax, it's not fair to people who are not paying much tax now and all of a sudden have to pay like a 9% national sales tax. They would not consider it fair. you or I might, but they wouldn't. Any system of taxation the government has, there's going to be a big bureaucracy to enforce it and to intimidate us into paying it. They have to check up on all the merchants. Every merchant in the country would be employed as a tax collector for the government. So don't think that if we had a consumption tax that there would be no IRS. That would never happen. The best thing to do would be get rid of the 16th Amendment and the income tax and replace it with nothing. I don't support any tax, John is asking. You can look up reserve requirements. David Kramer has a question about how much does the Fed require a bank to keep on reserve. They change it all the time. You can look it up, even Google the Fed's reserve requirements. But it's not unusual for it to be in the 5% range. Yeah, the Fed is interesting. The Fed is claiming that it's going to start spying on us and through Facebook to find out who its critics are. But I don't know, you know, what does it plan on doing it with the information? I have heard about that. But who knows? I mean, they might use the information to claim that you're a terrorist. And you're planning on opposing the war in Iran by criticizing the Fed. Stranger arguments have been made about treason. And so I have no idea what they could do with that information. Okay, if I were in charge, how would I raise money to pay for government? Well, if I were immediately in charge, you can look at it historically. The original American system was that the only type of taxation was indirect taxation through tariffs on imports and a very few select excise taxes on a few items. But even as late as the 1860s, tariffs on imports accounted for over 90% of federal tax revenue, and that was deemed to be sufficient to finance the constitutional functions of government from 1789 until the 1860s, and beyond that, the late 19th century, you still had about 70% or so of federal tax revenue was taken from tariffs on imports. But the key there is what Rothbard says. The key is that government spending was small enough that it was agreed upon generally that the legitimate constitutional functions of government could be financed through mostly the tariff and a few excise taxes. There was no income tax until 1913. But then once you get into the regime of unlimited governmental power with no constitutional constraints, well, there's just never enough money on the planet to fund what the government would like to do. Even despite all the belly aching and whining about federal austerity, we learned a few days ago that federal spending increased by at least 5% last year, so there's been no cutting of anything. And so historically, you could think of paying for the constitutional functions of government only with tariffs, but then you'd have to get agreement that government should be bound by a constitution and should not be an unlimited totalitarian regime, which is what it is today. Of course, if I had my magic wand, we would have no federal government. Government would be all local. If you wanted government, it would be close to home. Let's see, other questions that are coming down the pike here. I'll have to look up multiple inverted pyramids this week. I'm not an expert in that, for sure. Excuse me. Well, things are slowing down here. Let's see. What do I think of Ron Paul's economic plan? Well, of course, it's head and shoulders above the rest from my perspective. I mean, he's announced today that he would cut $1 trillion out of spending. No one that I know of, none of the other people have promised to cut a penny. Herman Cain, I heard Herman Cain in person in Florida say that he wants government to be revenue neutral with his tax plan, which means the government will spend not a penny less than it is now. And then he also wanted to expand the military to make it even bigger. So he's the so-called front runner at the time, for the time being, in the Republican Party, and he wants to spend more than Obama. He wants the status quo, which is what revenue neutrality is. And on top of that, he said he wants the military to be bigger than it is under either the Bush or Obama administrations. And so, compared to that, Ron Paul's economic plan is tremendous. It focuses on the real issue, not the fair tax or the flaky tax or the fanny tax or whatever you want to call it, this or that, the 999 tax. Spending, that's the problem. It's not how the chicken is plucked, it's the fact that the chicken is being plucked of its feathers. That's the problem. All this talk about different types of taxes is just arguments over the best way to pluck a chicken. And you and I as taxpayers are the chickens. And of course, we don't really like being plucked, at least I don't. Any participants can weigh in, I guess. Chris is asking all participants about this. Well, seeing, I think the actual presidential debate has just started, so I guess that's why we've run out of gas. So if there are no more questions, Todd wants the fair tax. Well, that's fine. Good luck with that. Fair tax, if everyone pays a 50% flat income tax, that's fair. But then again, it's not fair, is it? I mean, we don't, when I go to the store, say I make $1 million a year, and I'm going to pay 50% of that, $500,000 in tax. You make $100,000 a year, so you pay $50,000 in tax. Well, when we go to the store, I don't pay double what you pay for bread and milk and things. No one would consider that to be fair. When it comes to taxation, people think some sort of percentage, the same percentage that everyone pays is a fair tax. But a good case can be made that no, that's grossly unfair. And so the fair tax is not even fair as far as I'm concerned. Does the Fed fail? Well, the Fed has already failed, and that it is already proven that it is utterly powerless to do anything to improve the economy. That's a failure. It's still in existence, but it's failed. Now, I guess that's one good thing about the current events is that government has proven in spades that it is totally incapable of improving things. The next step is to have the people understand that it's the government that created this mess in the first place with its monetary policy. Well, I guess we're about run out of gas. I guess we could wrap it up a little early tonight and call it a night and have fun watching the debate. Thanks again. We have one more class on war, and hopefully I'll put together some good materials for that class. And I hope you keep on learning. I hope you learned a lot tonight, and especially by reading the Rothbard articles, which I think are just great. And so have a good night.